Peaceful Parenting by Stefan Molyneux, 21. Part 3. Evidence. This book has covered the theory of and moral arguments for peaceful parenting. It has also provided a large number of practical examples of peaceful parenting, the mindset, actions, and conversations that allow you to interact with your children in a moral manner. The last part of this book goes into intense detail about the scientific, social, biological, and medical evidence for the virtues of peaceful parenting. It's one thing to know that smoking is expensive, wasteful, and unpleasant to those around you. It's quite another thing to know that smoking will likely kill you. It's important to be aware that the information in this last section of the book will be extremely disorienting and upsetting. Our society is currently founded on the abuse of children. Almost all of our educational, social, legal, and political institutions rely on children being abused and broken before being delivered into adulthood. This is why the information that you are about to consume has been systematically and deliberately kept hidden from you. The only way to improve the world is to improve childhood. Those who currently profit from a broken world require that children be broken. Those who profit from the sale of cigarettes will try to keep the dangers of smoking hidden from you. Those who profit from breaking children will try to keep the dangers of child abuse hidden from you. It is a grim reality that is bewildering, disorienting, and fundamentally unnerving. Be of courage, though, I implore you. Although this information is grim and upsetting, it represents our greatest hope for the future. Ideologies have failed to improve the world. Politics has failed to improve the world. Hedonism, subjectivism, relativism, distractions, mind-altering drugs, promiscuity, education, the internet, these have all failed to substantially improve the world. Either there is something we have yet to try, or the world cannot be improved. Fortunately, peaceful parenting is the undiscovered country whose exploration will save us all. But first, we have a brutal desert to cross. The desert of data. Let us begin. Does society truly love its children? This is perhaps the most essential question, because if society truly does love its children, then treating children even better will not achieve much good. If you are very unhealthy but already eat well and exercise, increasing the quality of your diet and exercise will probably not improve much. On the other hand, if you are unhealthy and eat badly and don't exercise, you can at least pursue the possibility of improving your health by changing your habits. One central thesis is that parents claim to love their children, but usually use violence against them. The claim of love is used as a cover for the violence. If this thesis is true, then society will claim to love its children, but such claims will be denied by the empirical evidence of how children are treated in society. Let's look at the reason and evidence. We gave the artificial intelligence, GPT-4, this exact prompt. Exhaustively generate a list of social issues that people draw attention to. Order the list by importance based on the attention society gives the topic. Focus on the US only. Child welfare, which encompasses child abuse, did not appear on the list until we asked it to continue the list in a second prompt. In all, it was number 19 on the list. This is not bulletproof research, but it is an essential data point. GPT-4 has an estimated 1.8 trillion parameters and was trained on gigabytes upon gigabytes of human expression. Implicit in that are the things that people talk about and focus on the most. Empirical priorities. This is the combined list generated by GPT-4. 1. Racial and ethnic inequality. Issues such as the Black Lives Matter movement, racial profiling, and police brutality. 2. Healthcare, affordability, access, and quality of healthcare, including debates over policy proposals. 3. Economic inequality. Income inequality, wage stagnation, job security, and the wealth gap. 4. Climate change and environmental issues. Concerns over wildfires, hurricanes, sustainable energy, pollution, and conservation. 5. Gender equality and women's rights. Wage gaps, workplace discrimination, reproductive rights, and the hashtag MeToo movement. 6. LGBTQ+ rights. Debates over marriage, military service, discrimination protections, and transgender rights. 7. Immigration. The status of undocumented immigrants, DACA, border security, and refugee policies. 8. Gun control, mass shootings, and debates over the Second Amendment and firearm regulations. 9. Education. Public school funding, college tuition, student debt, and educational equity. 10. Criminal justice reform, sentencing guidelines, prison privatization, drug decriminalization, and police department reforms. 11. Mental health crisis, stigma, and the rise in suicides and addiction. 12. Housing and homelessness, urban housing crises, affordability, and homelessness. 13. Veterans issues, mental health, homelessness among veterans, and post-service care and support. 14. Native American rights, land rights, environmental degradation on reservations, and cultural preservation. 15. Drug abuse and addiction, the opioid epidemic and the effects of addiction on communities. 16. Internet and technology, privacy concerns, cybersecurity, the digital divide, and social media effects. 17. Religious freedom versus discrimination, balancing religious rights with discrimination concerns. 18. Election and voting rights, gerrymandering, voter suppression, and mail-in voting debates. 19. Child welfare, foster care systems, child abuse, and children's rights. 20. Food insecurity, access to affordable, nutritious food, and food deserts. 21. Affordable child care, the cost of child care services, parental leave policies, and implications for working families. 22. Elderly care, challenges of an aging population, access to healthcare, and social security. 23, disability rights, accessibility, discrimination, and rights of people with disabilities. 24, human trafficking, labor and sex trafficking, and countermeasures. 25, animal rights and cruelty, debates over animal testing, factory farming, and wildlife treatment. 26, substance regulation, legalization and regulation of substances, notably marijuana. 27, free speech and censorship, balancing free speech rights with concerns like hate speech and misinformation. 28, right to privacy, government surveillance, data mining by corporations, and individual privacy rights in the digital age. 29, and so on and so forth. So, society may claim to care about its children, but in reality, child welfare is very low on the list of priorities. The dangers of smoking versus the dangers of child abuse. One way we can determine society's actual preferences is to note the efforts and energies put into warning citizens of the various dangers to their health and well-being. For many decades, society has hammered home the message that cigarettes are very dangerous and everyone should stop smoking. I'm sure you have heard anti-smoking messages hundreds or thousands of times. Since the 1950s, smoking rates have dramatically declined. What is more dangerous for people? Smoking or child abuse? Because society claims to care about things that are harmful or dangerous, especially if they cause ill health, death, then whatever reduces the lifespan as a whole must be roundly condemned, right? Let's pull together some data points on the harm of child sexual abuse. For brevity, we will focus on only the U.S. First, we must talk about a central measure of child abuse, adverse childhood experiences, ACEs. ACEs were developed to help quantify harmful events or experiences among children. The ACE study was a collaboration between Kaiser Permanente and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, designed to examine the long-term relationship between ACEs and a variety of health behaviors and outcomes throughout the lifespan. We will discuss ACEs in more detail later. Adverse childhood experiences. There are 10 types of ACEs. Physical abuse, any intentional act that causes physical harm through bodily contact. Sexual abuse, any forceful, unwanted, or otherwise abusive sexual behavior. Psychological abuse, any intentional act that causes psychological harm, such as gaslighting, bullying, or guilt tripping. Physical neglect, failure to help meet the basic biological needs of a child, such as food, water, and shelter. Psychological neglect, failure to help meet the basic emotional needs of a child, such as attention and affection. Witnessing domestic abuse, observing violence occurring between individuals in a domestic setting, such as between parents or other family members. Witnessing drug or alcohol abuse, having a close family member who misused drugs or alcohol. Mental health problems, having a close family member or otherwise important individual experience mental health problems. Imprisonment, having a close family member or otherwise important individual serve time in prison. Parental separation or divorce, parents or guardians separating or divorcing on account of a relationship breakdown. Prevalence. 63.9% of adults report at least one ACE. 17.3% experience four or more ACEs. Adverse childhood experiences versus smoking. Let's compare ACEs to smoking. Smoking is chosen behavior mostly by adults. Children who smoke are experiencing parental neglect and enablement, an ACE. Even if they start smoking before adulthood, all smokers choose to keep smoking as adults. It is willed behavior that has to be sought out and paid for, and often involves significant inconvenience since it is hard to find places to smoke. Child abuse is unchosen by the victims, externally inflicted on helpless, dependent babies, toddlers, and children. Surely, as a society, we should focus at least as much on destructive abuse inflicted on helpless children as on voluntary behaviors chosen by adults? Ah, you might say, but perhaps the risks and dangers of smoking are far greater than the risks and dangers of child abuse. Even if this were true, this would not overcome the involuntary nature of child abuse versus the voluntary choice to smoke. But what if it wasn't true? What if the health effects of child abuse were far worse than the health effects of smoking? Wouldn't that be more than strange? For society to focus on behaviors chosen by adults that were far less dangerous than violence and neglect inflicted on helpless and dependent children? Let me ask this another way. Do you know how dangerous smoking is? Of course you do. Everyone does. Now, do you know the long-term health effects of child abuse? Almost certainly not. This next set of data will change you forever. Long-term health risks of child abuse. Risks. Individuals with four or more ACEs were 176% more likely to develop any disease before age 70. Mortality risk and ACEs. Those with four or more ACEs had a mortality rate 97% higher than those with no ACEs. P less than 0.001. ACEs can reduce life expectancy by 20 years. Roughly, 41% of respondents reported having no ACEs. Please note that not all negative childhood experiences are captured by the ACE questionnaire. 22% reported one ACE, and 8.7% reported five or more ACEs. 17% experienced four or more ACEs. Let's compare that to smoking cigarettes. Prevalence. 11.5% of people in the U.S. smoke. This means that there are almost 40% more children who have four or more ACEs than there are adult smokers. Risk. Current smoker, increased risk of mortality equals 176% for women, 180% for men. Life expectancy for smokers is at least 10 years shorter than for non-smokers. Thus, smoking is only roughly half as lethal as significant child abuse. On average, smokers lose 10 years of their life. Victims of significant child abuse can lose 20 years of their lives. Yes, smoking exposes you to a myriad of health problems, but ACEs are almost certainly underreported. Who underreports smoking? Smokers can quit at any time. Helpless children are trapped in abusive households for close to 2 decades. Smokers get enormous social, medical, and pharmacological help to quit the habit, from support groups to nicotine patches to hypnosis. What help do most children get? Little, if any. Yet society spends almost infinitely more time, money, and attention on the negative outcomes of smoking than on the negative outcomes of child abuse. Why is that? But it gets worse. Spending on child sexual abuse awareness. We can measure society's priorities by how it spends its money. So, childhood sexual abuse is inflicted on 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 5 boys. 33% of girls, 20% of boys. And surely the number is much higher given the stigma of reporting, especially for boys. So for every 1 adult smoker, there are roughly 3 little girls and 2 little boys who are sexually abused as minors. Adults choose to smoke. Children are always unwilling victims of sexual abuse. How much is spent by the U.S. federal government on child sexual abuse awareness, research, and prevention? This data is not very accessible. What we did find was U.S. federal government's prevention of child sexual abuse research investment increased from $0 in 2019 to $2 million by 2022. For every $3,125 spent on punishing offenders, only $1 is spent on prevention research. Let's look at the CDC 2022 budget and make some comparisons. So these are graphs that are in the appendix, which are not particularly easy to put into the audiobook. Let's look at the numbers. Opioid overdose prevention and surveillance, $713,369,000. Cancer prevention and control, $385,799,000. Safe motherhood / infant health, $295,799,000. Intentional injury, $283,550,000. Social determinants of health, $153,000,000. Environmental health activities, $150,600,000. Nutrition, physical activity, and obesity, $128,100,000. Tobacco, PPHF, $128,100,000. Community and Youth Violence Prevention, $115,100,000. Tobacco, $109,400,000. Rape prevention, $101,750,000. Heart disease and stroke, $86,030,000. Environmental Health Laboratory, $67,750,000. Racial and ethnic approach to community health, $63,950,000. Heart disease and stroke, PPHF, $57,075,000. Diabetes, $52,075,000. Childhood lead exposure prevention, $46 million. Maternal mortality review committees, non-ad, $43 million. Lead exposure registry, $30 million. Firearm injury and mortality prevention research, $25 million. Oral health, $19,500,000. Environmental health PHS evaluation transfer, $17 million. Adverse childhood experiences, $12 million. Suicide prevention, $12 million. Arthritis, $11,500,000. Domestic violence community projects, $10,500,000. Climate and health, $10 million. Child sexual abuse prevention, $1.5 million. This is after decades of research showing the harm of child abuse. This is not a call for more federal spending, just a reflection of society's priorities. National debts, unfunded liabilities, and children. As a society, we constantly tell ourselves how much we care about our children and how many sacrifices we are willing to make on their behalf. Now, words are easy. Deeds are hard. What are the facts? Are we, in fact, willing to make significant sacrifices for the sake of our children? And there are some pretty big numbers that would argue otherwise. The national debt is the excess money that we greedily consume now at the expense of our children, enslaving our descendants for many generations at this point. If we truly loved our children, we would bequeath them a fiscal surplus just in case something bad happened in their lifetimes. If a man cares for his children, he should try to leave them something in his will rather than spending every last dollar on his own life. If we bury our children in enslaving debt, we cannot also claim to love them. The national debt is a form of taxation without representation, a form of intergenerational theft that allows us to sell the future productivity of our offspring for the sake of, quote, free goods and services in the here and now. If a father claimed to love his children but turned out to have been secretly running up hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt on their credit cards, debts they could not escape, would we believe his claims of how much he loved them? Of course not. We cannot defraud our children of their future while simultaneously claiming to love them unconditionally. If you doubt this, just understand that every politician wants to get elected, and no successful politician in living memory has ever run on the platform of radically cutting government spending in order to pay off the national debt and thus liberate the children from enslavement to mostly foreign bankers. Politicians want to win, but they never ask the population to sacrifice free stuff for the sake of the children. These politicians know that if they actually asked the adults in their society, particularly the parents, to make financial sacrifices for the sake of their children, they will never get elected, because almost nobody actually really wants to do that. Okay, what kind of numbers are we talking? It varies around the world, of course, with Japan being the worst offender, but let's focus on the United States. Here we go. Quote, in 2022, the gross federal debt of the United States amounted to around 92,000 528 US dollars per capita. This is a moderate increase from the previous year when the per capita national debt amounted to about 85,552 US dollars. Let's look at the forecast of the gross federal debt of the United States going forward to 2033. Quote, by 2033, the gross federal debt of the United States is projected to be about 51.99 trillion US dollars. This would be an increase of around 21 trillion US dollars from 2022, when the federal debt was 30.84 trillion US dollars. These numbers have gotten much worse since this research was first conducted. There were 73.1 million children in the U.S. as of 2020. What happens when the children grow up to pay taxes on the debt? Let's run some rough numbers. $52 trillion divided by 73.1 million children means that each child is burdened with $711,354 of debt just for the privilege of being born. Unfunded liabilities are the promises that the U.S. government has made to its citizens that it does not have the money to pay. As of 2021, the combined unfunded liabilities for Social Security and Medicare were $163.2 trillion. This means that each child is born holding a debt of $2 million. $243,558. Combining the two numbers gives a debt per child in the United States of almost $3 million. What does this mean? Well, the average American will pay $532,910 in taxes throughout his or her lifetime. That is a third, 33.23%, of all estimated lifetime earnings, $1,571,244, spent on taxes. Residents of New Jersey will pay the most in lifetime taxes, $1,168,919, and people in Wyoming will pay the least, $338,079. Thus, Americans take home just over $1 million over the course of working for an entire lifetime. This means that American children are born into a debt that would take them three lifetimes to pay off, assuming no interest, of course. Assuming a 40-year payout and an interest rate of only 5%, the debt, it's utterly and completely impossible to pay off, no matter what time frame you choose. The interest payments on $3 million over 40 years are $150,000 a year, vastly more than most Americans make. In fact, after 40 years, $9 million is owed, not $3 million. At 8% interest, the interest payments are $240,000 a year. Even at 3%, we are looking at $90,000 a year just to pay the interest on the debt. After taxes, the average American takes home $38,100 per year. Even if we assume no interest rate at all, it would take almost two lifetimes for the average American to pay off his or her share of the national debt and unfunded liabilities. As soon as any real interest rate is added to the equation, the debt cannot be paid off, no matter how hard or long the average American works. We think that slavery is something in the distant past. We are wrong about that. Slavery is very real, and we forced it on our children through our greed and irresponsibility. If you want to know how much Americans care for their children, ask yourself what would happen to a politician if he or she demanded that taxpayers give up benefits in order to reduce the debt for their kids? Exactly. Spanking and health effects. Society claims to be laser focused on potential dangers to children's health. Are they getting too much screen time? Are they too sedentary? Are they getting enough exercise or healthy food? What are the effects of vaccines or cell phone radiation? The list goes on and on. The prevalence of spanking in America is appalling. Over a third of parents in the U.S. report using corporal punishment on children less than 1 year old. 85% of American youth have been physically punished by parents during childhood or adolescence, according to parental self-reports, which is surely undercounting these assaults. Over 25% of parents have also reported using objects such as a hairbrush or wooden spoon to hit their children, according to a 1995 survey. Parents are very concerned with the health of their children. So, we must ask the question, is spanking unhealthy for children? The answer has been blindingly clear for decades. I've been reporting on this for 15 years. Why do parents not know the answer? Here are the facts. Quote, physical punishment is increasingly viewed as a form of violence that harms children. This narrative view summarizes the findings of 69 prospective longitudinal studies to inform practitioners and policymakers about physical punishment's outcomes. Our review identified 7 key themes. First, physical punishment consistently predicts increases in child behavior problems over time. Second, physical punishment is not associated with positive outcomes over time. Third, physical punishment increases the risk of involvement with child protective services. Fourth, the only evidence of children eliciting physical punishment is for externalizing behavior. Fifth, physical punishment predicts worsening behavior over time in quasi-experimental studies. Sixth, associations between physical punishment and detrimental child outcomes are robust across child and parent characteristics. Finally, there is some evidence of a dose-response relationship. The consistency of these findings indicates that physical punishment is harmful to children and that policy remedies are warranted. Quote, a meta-analysis of 5 decades of research has proven the detrimental effects of spanking. Meta-analysis focused specifically on spanking were conducted on a total of 111 unique effect sizes representing 160,927 children. 13 of 17 mean effect sizes were significantly different from zero, and all indicated a link between spanking and increased risk for detrimental child outcomes. Effect sizes did not substantially differ between spanking and physical abuse or by study design characteristics. Quote, this study used propensity score matching based on the lifetime prevalence and recent incidence of spanking in a large and nationally representative sample, N equals 12,112, as well as lagged dependent variables to get as close to causal estimates outside an experiment as possible. Whether children were spanked at the age of 5 years predicted increases in externalizing behavior problems by ages 6 and 8. Even after the groups based on spanking prevalence or incidence were matched on a range of socio-demographic, family, and cultural characteristics and children's initial behavior problems. These statistically rigorous methods yield the conclusion that spanking predicts a deterioration of children's externalizing behavior over time. So, if we love our children and want what is best for them, why do we hit our children? When it is violent and immoral and very, very bad for them. Since parents love their children and want what is best for them, why doesn't the media constantly remind parents about the harm that spanking does to their offspring? If the media found that some incredibly prevalent substance was harming children, which was easy to protect them from, wouldn't the media be eager to tell parents? And wouldn't parents be eternally grateful for being repeatedly informed about the dangers to their children? Yet this does not happen. The media delivers what people want to watch. The media does not generally inform parents about the harm done to their children through physical punishment. There can only be one reason for this. The parents don't want to know. In fact, the parents would likely be very angry to be told this, which means that they don't love their children because they would rather keep hitting them than protect them from the dangers of physical assault. The world is very simple to understand if we simply look at the available data. But it gets even worse, as it usually does. Remember COVID? Spanking versus COVID. Spanking produces clear negative outcomes for the vast majority of children. When we compare the harm done to children with the risks that children faced over the course of the COVID-19 pandemic, we can clearly see the difference in how society deployed its resources to deal with these two different dangers to children. Children faced absolutely minuscule risks from COVID-19, but schools were closed. Novel vaccination technology was forced upon children. Parks and recreational facilities were closed, and children's lives were completely overturned for years, resulting in massive increases in depression, anxiety, learning losses, and even child suicides. From a recent paper. Quote, "For children, the collateral damage of the COVID-19 pandemic response has been considerable. Nearly insurmountable educational losses, deteriorating mental health, low routine childhood vaccination rates, 39 billion missed school meals by January 2021, and millions of estimated life years lost among students in the USA alone. All for a virus that endangered or killed virtually no children." Imagine if society committed the same resources to combating life-threatening child abuse that it committed to battling a virus that did almost no deadly harm to children. Now, ask yourself why we didn't. Government schools and child abuse. I'm sure you have heard of the Catholic child abuse scandals going back many decades. Did the media report on the scandals because it cares about child abuse, or because exposing these corruptions follows the general modern anti-Christian narrative? Well, if you cared about child abuse in institutions, you would do your research to find out which institutions abuse children the most, right? It's not the church. Not even close. Children are far more abused in government schools than they ever were in the church. Quote, "In the last decades, studies have uncovered troubling statistics about the occurrence of sexual abuse of children in schools, with a large study estimating that 9.6% of students in grades 8 through 11 had been victimized. Quote, Harris Interactive administered survey to a nationally representative sample of 2,064 students in grades 8 through 11 from 1,559 public schools in fall 2000, asking about their experiences with sexual harassment or abuse during their school lives. Specifically, questions in the survey included who committed the harassment or abuse, students, teachers, or other school employees, and when and where the incident happened. As Shakeshaft's 2004 secondary analysis of the AAUW data indicated, nearly 9.6% of students in the sample reported being victims of sexual misconduct by educators. How much worse is it for children in government schools? Hofstra University researcher Cheryl Shakeshaft has deeply studied the problem. Here is her assessment. Think the Catholic Church has a problem, she said. The physical sexual abuse of students in schools is likely more than 100 times the abuse by priests. Reporter Wayne Logerson has pointed out that a federal report said that 422,000 California public school students would be victims before graduation, a number that dwarfs the state's entire Catholic school enrollment of 143,000. During the first half of 2002, the 61 largest newspapers in California published almost 2,000 articles about sexual abuse in Catholic institutions, mostly regarding past abuses. Over the same 6 months, those newspapers ran only 4 studies about the federal government's discovery of the much larger and ongoing abuse scandal in government schools. In other words, the media reported 500 times more on stories about the past that affected 1% of the number of children abused in government schools. The current victim of an educator received 50,000 times less attention than the past victim of a priest. I hope that you understand that the multi-decade focus on the sexual abuse of children in Catholic churches is motivated almost exclusively by rampant anti-Christianity. This is evident from the simple fact that children are much more likely to be sexually abused in government schools. But you never hear about that, do you? Also, the Catholic Church is a voluntary institution. Children are generally compelled to attend government schools, and all taxpayers are compelled to pay for those schools. Far more children attend government schools than go to Catholic churches. Do we care about the abuse of children? If we did, there would be endless media articles exposing the prevalence of child sexual abuse in government schools. There is not. Asked and answered, very sadly. Also, when we look at the outrage and protests and riots after the death of George Floyd and compare them to the utter absence of organized outrage after reports were released revealing the massive sexual abuse of children in government schools, we can see exactly how largely indifferent most parents are to the victimization of their children. There should have been mass protests, marches, hearings, investigations, a massive rise in homeschooling in order to protect children. But almost none of that happened. Do we, as a society, genuinely love our children? We don't seem to get too upset when our children are regularly sexually abused, molested, and raped in government schools. I wish it were different. It is not. Schools and bullying. Children are generally forced into schools that their parents are forced to pay for? How often are they bullied? Quote, 49.8% of tweens, 9 to 12 years old, said they experienced bullying at school, and 14.5% of tweens shared that they experienced bullying online. Pachin and Hinjula, 2020. What are the effects of bullying? Quote, students who experience bullying are at increased risk for depression, anxiety, sleep difficulties, lower academic achievement, and dropping out of school. Centers for Disease Control, 2019. Students who are both targets of bullying and engage in bullying behavior are at greater risk for both mental health and behavior problems than students who only bully or are only bullied. Centers for Disease Control, 2019. Bullied students indicate that bullying has a negative effect on how they feel about themselves, 27%, their relationships with friends and family, 19%, their schoolwork, 19%, and physical health, 14%, National Center for Educational Statistics, 2019. Tweens who were cyberbullied shared that it negatively impacted their feelings about themselves, 69.1%, their friendships, 31.9%, their physical health, 13.1%, and their schoolwork, 6.5%. Pachin and Hinduya, 2020. Where are the marches, the protests, the outrage, the steadfast demands for change? Remember how angry and aggressive people were about the unvaccinated during COVID? I don't see that happening with the protection of children.